Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. It's Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
How you doing, honey?
Oh, Vegas, baby Vegas.
We had the opposite weekend.
I know, isn't that so
funny? You were crazy.
I was crazy town. Well, Remy's birthday party was at Pump It Up on, so as you know, like I didn't think parents, it's like kids. It was basically a drop-off party.
Yes, but you didn't tell me. You know I have to get him a present.
No,
my
it's
favorite
not until
thing.
I know, you're so sweet, but you have time. You did it early so he could have his friends there before
gotcha.
The summer. That's
okay.
All.
Okay, July what?
Still got time. 5th.
Oh, he's right after Independence
exactly.
Day.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, so he just wanted it early.
Perfect.
So his friends before the summer. And
so you did that on Saturday?
So I did that on Saturday.
Yes.
And then Sunday morning, we got up and went to Vegas because my brother was there with his girlfriend. And it's just so rare to see him, like, on the western side. And so I was like, all right, I'll do it. And so, yes, yeah, so we drove up. And Sunday was fine. Not as trafficky on the way
right.
back, 7 hours.
Yeah, so, it's terrible.
It was tough.
And
was
tough. That's really far, because on a bad day for us, it's like 6.5. You're closer than we are.
Oh, yeah.
So it must have been brutal.
It was pretty bad at points. With 2 kids under 4 feet, 2 inches. So, yeah.
But they have their iPads.
Thank God for the iPads, is all I have to say.
Do both of them have them?
Oh, my God. If I could plug it into their ears, I would. Yes. So, yeah.
And we did the opposite. We went to... Well, we did Vegas a couple weeks ago.
Yes,
so
exactly.
We went to Pismo Beach and mm-hmm. Morro Bay, and I proudly say that we got 24,000 steps on.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, 24,000 on Sunday and
wow.
21,000 yesterday.
And Chris, too.
Yes. Well, I
wow.
make him go with me on
yeah,
walks.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. He may have gotten a few extra because he had to go run off and do something
oh
else.
God.
So he may have outdid me by 1,000.
And where do you stay in Vegas again? What's your hotel? I was trying to remember.
Well, the Stratosphere. That's just because I get everything
exactly.
for free.
Exactly.
Right.
So nice.
Yeah.
I was telling David.
You were at the Cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
That's a really pretty place.
It was. You know what's funny? I stayed at the Venetian,
uh-huh.
and I love the Venetian.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was just beautiful with the canals. And Cosmo was like a hip-hop club.
Yeah, it's very cosmopolitan, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yes,
they have
exactly.
the, like, 360-degree windows all around the hotel kind of thing.
Oh, my God.
Am I thinking of the same one?
I don't know, but you're probably right. I probably didn't explore the amenities that I could have.
And I hear that you crashed a bachelor party.
It was so funny. There was two guys getting married, and they were power lifters. This is so funny. From Minnesota. So, of course, like, you know me and my big mouth, I talk to anybody. So we were talking, and they were great. They were super fun, and, you know, it was just a fun time. It was really funny because they have, like, a competition in 2 weeks. And so they're like, listen, we really can't eat. We're using our calories for beer.
Oh, God.
It was just, like, very funny. Yeah.
That is hysterical.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Now, you have to say what you told me before the show about London. That is the cutest thing on the planet.
Oh, about what he said
yes.
about the camera. Okay. So a while back, Dr. Deborah and I... what was it? Was it a year ago? 2 years ago.
Yeah,
maybe
Flying
now.
Flags Resort,
yes.
which they have those Airstreams, those
so
the silver
like,
bullets,
exactly.
right?
Exactly. So we had never done that as a family, and we decided, okay, let's do it. And so Deborah rented out it was like an Airstream. Which is like a camper van.
Right.
I don't know how you describe
right?
it to
yeah,
a normal
yeah.
person.
And it's silver. People see them on the road
yeah,
all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah, the old kind.
Yes.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. and you guys did the safari tent.
Yes. And
which was beautiful.
Yeah, it was great. And then remember London... Moose escaped. My dog
yes.
escaped. But so my younger son said the other day, like, I want to see Dr. Deborah and I want to see her camper van. And I said, you know, honey, that's not her. She was just renting it. And he's like, no, Mom. Yes, that is her. She had it. I'm like, no, it wasn't hers to keep. She was just renting it. But it was very funny.
Hey, I'm glad that I just rated above food.
Yes, exactly. It's a shocker. You should feel very, very lucky.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, you look great. You don't look
Thank
worse
you.
For the wear from your Vegas shenanigans.
Not like you, but, I mean, we didn't stay up all night. We did go to the buffet, though. We did do that.
Okay. Next time you have to come with me, and I'll show you a good time.
I can't wait. It'll be a totally different experience.
Funny. Oh, my goodness. Okay. So last week, we had the author of the book called Blossom, Your 7-Step Journey to Healing Childhood Sexual Abuse and Creating Your Dream Life. And that was really, really enlightening and very eye-opening. I just really loved
yes.
her message. So if you did miss that, you should definitely
It was really great because what I liked about it was just how it's sort of step by step of helping you, and you don't really, you can do, I mean, if you want to do it on your own, you can using this book if you don't feel comfortable seeing a therapist and things like that.
Yeah, and also it was nice that she said that you could do that with a group if you had a close friend of women who had also had been sexually abused and you felt safe with them, that it was a kind of guide that you could do together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Super interesting.
Very, very, very interesting. Okay, drum roll. Today we have Dr. Nisha Zenoff, who's a California licensed marriage and family counselor, psychotherapist, grief counselor, and dance movement therapist. She is the author of The Unspeakable Loss, How Do You Live After a Child Dies, published in 2017. The book includes her personal story after the death of her 17-year-old son and her insight as a grief counselor and psychotherapist of over three decades. It also offers support, guidance, and wisdom from from other bereaved families. The book was a finalist in the American Book Fest Best Book Awards for 2017 in the category of Health, Death, and Dying. Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah.
Welcome, Dr. Zenoff.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here with you.
So this is super interesting. So I actually came across your book in some sort of magazine. I'm trying to remember which one it was. And I was like, wow, this is amazing and powerful. And I had to reach out to you. So why did you decide to write this book?
First of all, thank you for reaching out to me.
Of course.
I actually never wanted to write a book. And I certainly never wanted to write a book with this title. I never wanted to have to read a book with this title. And I never wanted anyone else to have to read a book with this title.
Of course.
And as you mentioned, in 1980, my oldest son, Victor, died in a hiking accident in Yosemite National Park.
Oh, no.
It was a week before he was 18. And his death absolutely shattered my heart to a billion pieces and shattered my children's heart, my husband's heart. And I was already a psychotherapist and a grief counselor at that time.
Oh.
But I found that nothing I knew professionally helped ease any of my grief, pain, and devastation. So I reached out to other bereaved families who I consider the experts. And I started asking them the question that haunted me, how do you live after a child dies?
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of my research, which went into my doctoral dissertation. And then 15 years later, I started writing the book, which was published this year.
Wow, that's how tragic. I'm going to ask you a question that may seem odd, but curiously, what was the first thought that went through your mind when you heard the news?
Well, you won't believe this. I mean, the first thought that when the police came to the door and rang the doorbell, and I was home alone, and they said they were the police, and they asked me if I had a son named Victor. And in that moment, I knew inside myself that Victor was dead. I have no explanation for it. But then I said to the policeman, did he die today at 3 o'clock? I mean, obviously I went into such shock. Did he die today at 3 o'clock? I mean, a Saturday. Yeah, it was Saturday. And they looked at their papers and they looked up and they said, why, yes, he did.
Oh my.
How did you know? And so it's amazing that you asked that question, because earlier that day, I was having lunch with my mother up in Berkeley, and I started to feel ill, and I started dry heaving and ran outside of the building and sat on the curb and said to my mother, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I feel like I'm dying.
Oh,
and I asked her to drive back, because I felt too sick to drive back. And that is when Victor died.
Oh, unbelievable.
And it's unbelievable. So what actually happened as a result of that is that was my first glimpse of a connection that we have with each other that we have absolutely no explanations for. So in some way, in the moment that I heard he died, I got my first glimpse of hope. I didn't realize it then, of course, that it was a first glimpse of hope. But as I've looked back on it, that's what I realized.
Wow. Do you remember other moments in your life, like maybe he was at a friend's house or something where he maybe got a stomach ache or threw up, where you felt something about him? Did you always have that connected intuition with him?
Yes, we did, actually. We had a very psychic, spiritual connection.
Mm-hmm.
I was only 21 years older than he. And I think we grew up together in some way. So I do. I feel like we definitely had a connection before he died and after he died.
Well, that was going to be my next question for you, because I'm a huge believer in when people pass on that they are still connected to us and they can give us messages. And are you, do you believe the same?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I have my, for me personally, that's what keeps me sane and that's what keeps me living, is that I feel that I have connection with him, with my mother who died, with my grandfather who died. The spirits are very, very present in my life.
I'm always curious when people have that strong of a connection. Do they show up in certain particular ways? Like Kelly thinks that her grandmother hovers around our studio here now and again as a blue jay.
I see a blue jay and feathers.
Yes.
That's great. As a blue jay, that's marvelous. Yeah.
And I think my father shows up in my dreams a lot.
Yes.
A lot, yes. Mm-hmm. But how does it manifest for you?
It's very individual. And Victor shows up for me in a license plate. I can give you an example, or songs, or dreams, and any kind of synchronicity that happens.
So beautiful.
And so I'll give you an example, actually, which if my mother hadn't been with me, she said she would have thought I was nuts and making it up. So on the first anniversary of Victor's death, and it was Mother's Day, actually it wasn't the anniversary of his death, it was Mother's Day, and she and I went out to have lunch, and I said, well, we haven't heard from Victor yet, but I bet we're going to. And as we walked out of Golden Gate Park, there were two cars parked one in front of each other, and I looked at the license plate, and the first license plate said LUV, and the second license plate said VIC.
Oh my gosh.
Love, Vic.
I said
to my mother, look at that. Look at those two license plates. Just look. Just look. Am I seeing something? Am I going crazy? Mm-hmm. Or do those license plates say Love, Vic?
And she said, oh my God. So you were talking to the right person. I love this. And I actually have a very close friend who lost her father to brain cancer, and then her brother, he was like 36, to a rare blood disorder. And a few months later, she went up to a friend's apartment in New York, and something happened. She needed something under the sink, and she looked up under the sink at her friend's apartment, and her dad's last name was underneath the sink.
It was so interesting.
Oh my God.
Like, and it was not that common of a name, you know? So it was just sort of like, and she asked her friend, like, have you ever noticed this under the sink? And her friend's like, no. And so she thinks that that's a message from her dad or her brother too. And I totally think that. I mean, that's just
and
too
I think that's what's important, is that she thinks it's a message. So it's up to each one of us. We decide what's a message and what's not a message. Exactly. I don't believe anybody has to believe what I believe.
Right.
But, you know, if I feel good from it, if I feel peaceful, if it helps me connect with my loved ones or my child, then I'm all for it.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that's a really interesting topic, if we can go there for a minute, because there are many people who might be listening and many people out there who don't have afterlife beliefs, who don't believe that the spirits stay present to us. And when people who don't have that are grieving, in my experience, is they have a very different grief experience. Do you have any suggestions for people on how they stay hopeful or positive, heal their own grief when they can't hold on to that?
Well, I love that question, because I went to a conference last year, which I'm going to again this year. It's sponsored by The Compassionate Friends, which is a nonprofit grief support organization for families living after the death of a child. And there was a workshop there that fascinated me, because the title and the workshop was given by Peggy Johnson. And the name of the workshop was When Faith Is Not an Option. And I thought, I'm going to go to that workshop because I'm so far at the other end. I'd like to find out what Peggy has to say when faith is not an option. How did she get through it?
Right.
So she's been one of my teachers, and I write about it in my book because I was fascinated how she was getting through the death of her child by not having faith in something supernatural or life after death. And what I found was all the same things that help others of us who do have a faith are there, like relationships with other people, being in nature, doing good with other people or for other people, animals, remembering, having memories that are important, and living to honor her child.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Absolutely. Maybe you could speak a little bit about the differences between somebody, let's say, losing a spouse of 50 years versus losing a child, or losing a parent who, you know, they're older and it's almost like the natural course of things, if you will. But when it's a child, it's got to be so much different and so much harder to understand.
Well, I don't like to ever compare grief, actually. And I remember when I worked with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who is one of the pioneers, as you know, in death and dying.
Sure.
And I was there with a woman who had lost three children and a husband. And I thought, oh my God, I've only lost one child. You know, how can I have all this grief? And she has three children and a husband to grieve. And I remember Elizabeth saying, we never compare anyone else's grief. Your grief is your grief is your grief. Mm-hmm. And grief ultimately is all about love.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I think if you, I've heard people say, you know, the death of a child is the worst pain and the worst trauma any parent can endure.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't lost a spouse, and I haven't lost even a sibling.
Yeah.
So what I know is my experience losing my parents and grandparents, and how that compares to my losing my son. And because losing my child, it reverses nature. Children are not meant to die early,
right?
Even though unfortunately they are dying early all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an unusual thing. But the reversal of nature, it upsets your brain. The human brain isn't created to integrate the death of a child. It's something that we really don't know how to do
on a
brain level. So I don't like to compare people's grief. I had a mother once say to me that her grief was so great because her child was a vegetable for 15 years and hadn't died, and that grief was worse than death. So I really respect every person's grief. And there was an author who wanted me to name my book The Greatest Grief after the 9/11 episodes, because he said that the most difficult grieving people that were having the deepest grief, the greatest grief, were the parents that he worked with.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get myself to name my book that, because I'm not here to judge anyone else's grief. I just know I would not want anyone to have to ever experience the death of their child.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Yeah,
oh,
I can understand
that. So were you at all obsessed with wanting the details of how he died, or were you more in the position where you didn't want to know?
Victor had gone up to Yosemite with a young boy that he didn't know very well.
Mm-hmm.
And my first thought when I heard that Victor died, and after I established that it was at 3 o'clock, was he pushed off the side of the mountain?
Wow.
Did he commit suicide? Mm-hmm. Was he on drugs? What happened? Did he really just trip? Was it really, quote, just an accident?
Right.
And he had been using drugs in his life at a little earlier stage, and he had said he was totally clean. So I believed him.
Mm.
And I think he believed, about a month before he went up to Yosemite, he said he was really off of drugs completely, and he wanted to go to Yosemite to be healthy and get healthy. I was not so obsessed with how he died as I was what was his experience when he died. Like, I wanted to know that he wasn't afraid. I wanted to know that he wasn't alone, didn't feel lonely or scared, and was he calling out for me or his dad or his brother and sister?
Yeah.
That was where my pain was. And we did establish that it was an accident. He tripped and he fell 700 feet over the granite.
Oh my gosh.
And he and a fireman heard him falling through the brush and ran to hear what was going on over there, and ran to find whatever fell through the granite, and there he found Victor, and he did CPR and tried to save him, but he was already probably brain dead at that point.
Oh boy.
And I did go up to Yosemite, by the way. My brother and I drove up there, and I walked the path. I wanted to see what was in the path that he tripped on. I wanted to see the photographs that the rangers took of him, because I didn't get to see his body.
Right.
And I wanted to see, to make sure that it was Victor.
Yeah, makes sense.
So there's a lot of disbelief and not knowing. And so in that way, I was obsessing with wanting to make sure it was Victor.
My question is, because I can only imagine people say things after a child dies, and, you know, some of them, like, you know, it'll get better with time, or, and do you feel like, for those of us out there who haven't lost somebody but maybe know somebody who does, is there something that's comforting or that you
I'm so glad you're asking that question, actually. Yeah. It's one of my favorite topics. First of all, when our friends say things, they don't really mean to be hurtful, like God takes the best ones, or he's at a better place. Those kinds of things are not helpful, and they feel hurtful at the time. And it's really obvious that our family and friends are trying to take away our pain, or they wish they could take away our pain, bring our child back, do something to help, help fix us, which is impossible. And I think, through interviewing so many people and talking to so many bereaved families, the most important thing is for somebody to show up, whether if you're out of town, to show up with a phone call, a text message, an email, a letter.
Mm-hmm.
Show up, however you can show up personally, in person. And then the other thing is to listen. It's much more important to listen to bereaved families, parents, siblings, grandparents, aunts and uncles, to listen rather than talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we do talk to bereaved parents who have had a child die, it's so important not to be judgmental or criticize them, but you listen with an open heart.
Yeah.
And the best thing you can say, which is the truth, which is, there's no way that I know how you're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that I can even imagine what you're going through. I don't have the words.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the truth. And I like to tell people, you know, I don't expect you to know. I don't expect you to have the words. And I hope you never have to know. But if you let me talk, I'll tell you my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do love, and many parents agree with this, and some parents would rather not, is that I love people to mention my son Victor's name.
Mm-hmm.
And some parents don't want to hear their name of their child, except when they want to talk about him or her.
Yep.
So it's really like watching the feedback, asking, is it okay to talk about this right now? If you'd rather not, that's fine with me.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
I have a question, because this is actually personal in my life, and I won't name names, but somebody very dear to me has lost somebody very dear to her, who's also dear to me,
mm-hmm.
and
it's mm-hmm.
been,
so
you know, 7 years, and she hasn't moved in any direction. I mean, it's as if he just passed yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
She went to grief mm-hmm. counseling. You know, I talk to her a lot. She talks to me a lot, because I remind her of this person the most, and I always feel so sad, and I say to her, you know, I don't know what to say anymore. I know this hurts you so much. It's such a tragic loss. But every time she says, I should be the one, I shouldn't be here, I don't want to be here.
Mm.
And it's every time I speak with her, because I remind her of him so much. And
mm-hmm.
What can I say? Because I I'm not saying, like, I'm supposed to be successful, because I know that's not the thing. What do I say to be successful
right.
so that she'd move forward? is there anything mm-hmm. that I can do to embrace her, or just continue to do what I do, is listen and love her and say, I'm glad you're here, and
right.
and I know, you know, he's connected to you in every single way possible, and he's waiting for you, and, you know, mm-hmm. he'll have a big party for you when you arrive, but
right.
it's not today.
Yes. That's so beautiful. That's so beautiful. What you're doing is just so perfect. And for those of us who are watching our grieving friends and family, sometimes we have a time schedule. We want them to feel better. We want them to get on with life. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that grief, whether it's a child or a spouse or a family member or a dear friend, it does not have a timeline. There is no end. There are certain griefs, especially for the death of a child or a spouse, there's no timeline. Grief is a lifetime journey, and it changes. Our relationship to grief will change. And we have a, we don't have a choice whether that person died or not,
mm-hmm.
but we do have the power, and we do have the choice to decide how we're going to live with our grief, and how we're going to that we can use this grief to honor their lives by living a life more like they would have lived it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have choices after the death of a loved one, after the unspeakable loss. We have choices about how we're going to live.
Right.
And it's no one else's business. It's our business, what we choose.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're doing is so beautiful and supportive, especially the hug.
Well,
and the way you look in her eye or his eyes.
Right, right. I guess my biggest concern is the survivor guilt component, because it seems to me like that's the part that's mm-hmm. keeping her stuck, and it's not the healthy part. I don't know. Maybe you could speak to that more, because I know people have different versions about that.
Well, it's certainly very common to feel guilt when a loved one dies for whatever reason. I know with my mother, she died at the age of 81. And just last year, I started feeling so guilty that I didn't do more for her mm-hmm. when she was older.
Mm-hmm.
And survivor guilt is a normal experience. But what we do with that survivor guilt is our choice. And there are great support groups available. There are wonderful grief therapists available. There's a lot of grief work on the internet. I know for parents grieving the death of a child, as I mentioned before, the wonderful organization, non-denominational, non-profit organization, the Compassionate Friends, is marvelous. And there's also, this is an internet link that I'd like to tell you about. It's called Open to Hope.
Mm.
And it's for any type of grief.
Oh,
and it has radio. It also has television interviews. So, you know, getting help. No one should feel that they have to grieve or suffer alone. And getting help for these things like survivor guilt or anger or things that we feel we have to suffer with alone, because we're the only ones that have ever mm-hmm. felt that way, we'll find that, no, we're actually just an imperfect human being trying to survive losing someone that we love with all our heart, mm-hmm. and that we deserve to get help and support. And I so recommend people reaching out if they're more of an introvert and like to work individually, you know, a grief therapist, but there are wonderful support groups
yes.
all around. Hospice has some. And we all deserve to live our own life. And, you know, we can choose whether we want to suffer for the rest of our life. Suffering doesn't have to go on, even though the missing will continue forever.
Mm-hmm. Good point. That makes a lot of sense.
So it's so interesting. The person that I told you about, the father and brother who died, the mother
yes.
had an interesting question. And I see that it's in your book. And so I wanted to address it. We had on a grief author who wrote the grief recovery handbook.
Yeah, Russell Friedman, who passed away, actually.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
okay,
mm-hmm.
I gotta talk about
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah.
But anyway, she, you know, I told her that he was coming on the show, and she said, and it's so interesting because I had never thought about it. And she said, "What do I say when people say to me, 'How many children do you have?'" And
mm-hmm.
I loved that you addressed mm-hmm. that in your book. And I loved that this person, Jake, you know, who said, Jacob. Yes. He said, we had to go to court, and the jury selection, a man stood up, and when asked how many children he had, he said, I have four children. One is in heaven. I liked his present tense of expressing it, and I love that. Mm. It's really nice. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that you said that.
That's one of the hardest questions for any parent to answer, by the way, and and it comes up all the time in our culture. We are always asking, how many children do you have? And at first, I used to lie because I didn't want to bring up somebody else's pain. And you're at a dinner party, everybody's all happy, and they're saying, how many children do you have? And you look and stop and think, oh, I don't want to bring this up, because when you bring up my child dies, it stops the conversation and people don't know what to say or do.
Yes.
So I used to lie at first, and then as I worked on myself and I went inside myself and said, no, that's a lie. I truly will always be Victor's mother, not for as long as he lived, but as long as I live. Mm. So I can truly say I have three children.
Yep.
And then depending on who's asking the question, I will go further. If it's just small talk, I leave it alone. But if it's somebody that I feel is really interested, I will tell them the truth. And depending on who they are and their listening and their interest, I will stop myself from further with details or go further. But it's really up to each individual. What is your truth? And not to worry. That's why part of my title is The Unspeakable Loss. It's such an unspeakable loss but to talk about the death of a child in our culture. And so many bereaved parents don't want to bring up somebody else's pain. And then other friends don't want to bring up the grieving parent's pain by mentioning their child.
Right. And I'm glad you brought that up, too, because that was the other section of your book I saw, too, is, and it makes complete sense that, you know, once you lose a child and then you, it'd be really hard to see the family unit of other people still going on. It's like, oh, well, I used to get my nails done with my daughter and now I can't do that. And it's hard for me to see that, or imagine just hearing about, you know, my daughter, you know, is in college now and she's graduating, and you imagine the timeline of like, oh, you know, my child would have graduated by now or something like that.
That's exactly right. You are so right. And that is why you asked about, is the death of a child different than other grief? And I think that is one of the reasons it is different, because it's a life developmental grief. We go through the grief as we go through our life, if we are lucky enough and blessed enough to have other children, to watch them get married, to have children. And we do. We go through our mind, oh, well, Victor's not going to have children. Or so it's bittersweet in that way. And, I know I was going to give you an example. After Victor died, a week before he was 18, and we lived near Stanford University, and so I used to bike over there all the time, I couldn't go to Stanford because I did not want to see the young people in college. It just hurt. It made my stomach hurt. It made me want to throw up. I mean, it wasn't something I could control. It was just my reaction to my own devastation and grief. So here's an example of healing, which is, after many years and doing my own work of grief work, now when a family member invites me to a wedding or graduation, and it could be, you know, it's not, Victor won't be doing that, I can actually go and celebrate and feel good for that person. And when I feel my own sadness come up, I can go into the bathroom, cry if I want to, wipe my eyes, or say to myself, I'll cry later when I get home, and then I can enjoy being there. So that we learn to live with our grief, not that it ever goes away, but we learn to live with it. Rather than moving on, we learn to live with it.
That makes complete sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. It reminds me of a really, really close friend of mine who had twins, and the boy twin passed at 6 months old with serious complications and all that. And I just recently saw my friend and her daughter, who mm-hmm. is off to college. Wow. And that was my first thought. I was like, oh, I wonder. And it wasn't the right place to ask this sure. question of my girlfriend, because there were other people there and all that. But I'm going to ask her, like, what's it like for her mm-hmm. now to watch her daughter, who she's so proud of, and she's so amazing, doing all these things, and how much does that still come up for her about sure. her son? So I'm glad that we're speaking about this, because mm-hmm. it helps me to have more empathy and approach her with a kinder, more supportive mm-hmm. thing, instead of, you know, is that bothering you? You know,
yeah. Like, yeah, of course.
Yeah, oh my goodness.
You know, it's such a beautiful question and important question that you ask. I have a very close friend that we met actually through Compassionate Friends, who had twins, and her daughter died mm-hmm. 3 years ago, and her son is now getting ready to go off to college. Mm-hmm. Exactly the situation that you're yeah. referring to. And she is an amazing woman, very in touch with her feelings. And she has spoken about how excited she is for her son, how hard it is for him to go off without his sister, and how the grief still comes up for her. Mm-hmm. So it's living with both the joy and the celebration and the pain and the missing and the sadness all at the same time. It's really quite remarkable.
Right.
If these people, everyone is my hero. When we talk about this, that people survive, most parents survive.
Right.
I think it's incredible. It's been a mystery and it's a miracle. And that's why I was obsessed, as you used the word, with the question, how do you live after a child dies?
Yeah. Right.
We are speaking with Dr. Nisha Zenoff, the author of The Unspeakable Loss, How Do You Live After a Child Dies? This is so wonderful. I'm going to mm-hmm. shift gears a little bit, because I think this is also a really big component when a couple loses a child, a married
yes.
couple. And I know that that can be such an incredible strain on the marriage, because both people are individuals, yes. and they grieve differently, and one might be more ahead of the game than the other one, or more past it than the other one. I know I'm not using the right language here, but can you speak a little bit to, you know, how do you keep your marriage strong? How do you allow this to make you closer as a couple, mm-hmm. as opposed to something that divides you apart?
Yes, and I do write about that in the book, because it's one of the most asked questions that people ask. Did your son's death cause your divorce, when they know that I've been divorced? Mm-hmm. So any trauma to a couple brings up trust issues. And when a child dies, we each grieve differently, because our grief is as different as our love. Mm-hmm. So no one grieves the same. Everyone grieves differently. And there will be couples where one person would love to be close and be sexual, and the other person feels like a porcupine, doesn't want to be touched, and has no sexual desire or intimate desire. And so the best thing you can do is to, if you're lucky enough and have a great couple therapist around to work with, that's available, my book and there are other books that talk specifically about how you keep your marriage strong after the death of a child. So a lot has to do with compassion for yourself, for your own hurting, mm-hmm. and compassion for your partner, and giving each other space to be different, mm-hmm. and to heal at different times, to have grief at different times, and to have desire at different times. There was a myth that was going around for a lot of years, based on an incorrect study, that 75% of bereaved parents got divorced. And that was actually a misunderstanding of a study that wasn't very reliable.
Oh.
And recently, there was a retired professor from University of Washington, Dr. Shirley Murphy, and she conducted a study uh-huh. with 271 bereaved couples over 25 years. And she found that losing a child does not destroy a relationship. That's just not true. Mm-hmm. It can, mm-hmm. but it doesn't necessarily. And when I did my own research, I found the same thing. In fact, it can even make you closer,
yep.
but it will present bumps in the
yes,
road.
Sure.
There's no question about that. just, it, you know, it's developmental. It's based on growth. It's like, are you going to take this grief experience and close the curtains and let it destroy you for the rest of your life? That's a choice. You can do that if that's your choice.
Right.
Or are you going to use this horrible, horrible, devastating, undescribable loss? Mm-hmm. And are you going to use it to grow? Are you going to use it to become even more of who you are? These are choices.
That's great.
And when couples can talk to each other, just like all the good things in a relationship, all the good things about being open and honest with each other, sharing your pain. And why I suggested couples therapy is that when two people are grieving, there's not necessarily somebody home to hold that grief
right.
for the other person.
Sure.
And so it's really helpful to have a third person there to listen, to support the couple. It's one of the hardest things to have two people grieving and being in different places with their grief at the same time.
Absolutely. Dr. Nisha Zenoff, you've been a fantastic guest. Is there anything, we're close to running out of time, is there anything we didn't ask you that you want to make sure that our listeners hear, aside from, of course, we're going to promote the heck out of your book?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'd love for people to visit my website, which is theunspeakableloss.com.
Okay.
And I would like to just give you a quote from Bruce Feiler, who's a New York Times author. He said, "Love is bringing imaginativeness to the unimaginative."
Ah.
Actually, and it says, it's not a choice you make once, but over and over again. And I was just thinking about couples and families mm-hmm. who have experienced the death of a child or children, some their only child. This is really all about love on every level. Grief and love are the same, and it is love that helps the unbearable be bearable.
I love beautiful. That. That is beautiful. Thank
You're
you
such
so
a
much.
Gem. You're so sweet and so comforting, and thank you so much for coming on today.
And
oh,
for
thank
writing.
You. Thank you for the both of you for the work you're doing in the world. I'm so grateful.
Thank
so
you, sweet. And for writing this amazing book to
beautiful.
Help so many people.
Yes.
When I have time, I'm definitely going to read it cover to cover.
Yeah.
Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Unspeakable Loss from Dr. Nisha Zenoff.
Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. So we're going to actually shift subjects to a little bit of a brighter topic.
I know, because it was heavy.
Which is you, Kelly.
Oh, stop.
Uh-huh. And your book.
Yes.
Yes.
So I'm very excited. It's coming out June 26th.
Wow.
It's coming up. It's called Thriving with ADHD. It's a workbook for kids 7 to 12.
Okay.
And you should be getting it actually today, I think, or tomorrow.
Oh, I'm so excited.
So basically, I've shared many times on air, I have two boys with ADHD. So I felt like I've kind of been dealing with this for a long time. And then I got approached by my agent and it kind of fell into my lap and it just was meant to be. And I really enjoyed writing it. It was a beautiful process for me. And I loved asking my older son, because he's the prime demographic of the book. What do you think about this activity? Would you do it? How would you describe ADHD? I mean, it was great. It was really beautiful to have that person right there that I could ask all these questions to.
Now, have you had him sit down and actually go through all the
not
book?
The whole thing.
But he has done several of them.
Yes, exactly.
And he finds them to be helpful, of course.
Absolutely.
And he's not just stroking you because you're his mama.
Believe me, he will be honest.
I know.
Say to me, like, oh, I don't like that one, mom, or no, no, no. And I've said, oh, is it okay if I, you know, use your name here? And he said, or your friend's name. And he says, no, no, no. You know, so he speaks his mind.
Now, do your boys openly acknowledge to the public that mm-hmm. they have ADHD?
Remy wears it like a badge of honor. It's
okay.
The cutest thing, which
mm-hmm.
I think is great.
Well, that's what your book is about, too.
Yes.
It's like turning what's considered a liability into an asset.
He loves it. He talks about it all the time. London, I haven't had quite the conversation with him because he's five, and so I don't know if he'll totally understand. Mm-hmm. But
he wants to be just like his brother,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, so it's perfect. Yes.
Otherwise, he might feel left out. How come he has it and I don't?
Exactly.
How come he got that?
Yeah, exactly. One time, Remy asked me, I remember Remy said, do you think London has it? This was many years ago. And I said, I think so. But it's kind of funny. So it is nice that they can kind of share that together. But Remy has, and that's what I wanted. I wanted him to grow up and not have this be shameful or embarrassing. But I told him, you know, right when he was diagnosed, and we talked about it, and so that was my goal. And I think that's the goal of this book, is to really empower kids, and sort of, you know, and one of my sections in the book actually has, it's a list of all people who really kind of weren't successful at first, but then ended up being very successful, because I think a lot of kids with ADHD, I mean, they struggle a ton, but just knowing, hey, you know, look at all these people who've done really well in the world, but they've also struggled, or not necessarily had ADHD, but just had obstacles in the way.
Well, of course, and it's really about learning new tools, right? Developing a bigger toolbox so that you can challenge yourself and manage those things without getting mired and stuck in the misery of it, right?
Yes, exactly.
And would you say that there's less stigma now about that, or is it still difficult in the classroom?
No, I think it's less, thank God.
And are teachers more responsive and understanding than they used to be?
Absolutely.
Because I mean, so many kids suffered from serious self-esteem issues because of how they were like looked at like they were monsters from hell.
I was thinking back to my fifth grade class, and I remember this child, and I'm sure he had ADHD now that I look back, and he couldn't organize, because part of the problem with ADHD is executive functioning, so you can't really organize, and his desk was very messy. And I remember the teacher saying, look at blah blah blah's desk, it is a complete and total mess, this is disgusting.
Oh my
gosh. And he takes the desk and dumps out everything. And the shame that that little boy must have felt, you know, during that time. And so, and I think it was just that he thought he wasn't motivated, that he was lazy, that he didn't want to participate. I mean, you know, all the myths. And I think, you know, today it's so much better, in that their teachers are much more sensitive. They can probably recognize a little bit earlier, okay, this kid's not being lazy, or, you know, doesn't want to do what he's told. He's probably getting distracted, or, you know, has ADHD, or whatever they may say.
Yeah, it's funny, because I'll never forget, early in my career, I was still doing internships, and I was working at this group home, and it was for boys, and I was in charge of 6 boys, and I did group therapy with them every day, and sometimes I was in the classroom with them. And I'll never forget this one kid. He was tall and lanky and curly hair and these big blue eyes, and he, I won't name him by his name, but he was always in trouble and sent to my office because the teachers are just like pointing at him, why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? And he'd come in my office, but this was the best part. So I had to do a family therapy session. I was very, very young and very new at this. And it was the most amazing thing. So his brother, his sister, and his parents came in, and they were all ADHD.
Wow.
So I had 5 of them in my office. And I have to say, I was so ill-equipped on what to do. I know that I wasn't going to be punitive, because I understood.
Sure.
But there was no guidance in that family, because nobody actually had a handle on what they were doing. So, I mean, literally, I had 2 of them jumping on my desk, one of them twirling my, it was like everything you'd see in a comic movie, you know, twirling my chair around, you know, the as the father's telling the son to sit down, he's bouncing his leg and pounding his fist. And it was like, wow, this is really, really intense and very serious. So I'm so glad that you are sharing your experience and your professional experience. You work a lot with parents with ADHD. You must have incredible wisdom for them.
A little bit.
Yes, you do.
Because sometimes
on.
I think about my own
I wanted to do a whole show on your book, and you said no, you
humble pie. You know why? Because I think it's like, I'm always like, oh my God, imagine if people like kind of like took a look into my household, and they'd be like, oh, really? You know, because this is why I feel so bad. But you know what? That's the thing. I think as parents of ADHD kids, you do the best you can. And you know, and sometimes that's good enough, and that's something that I've learned.
Well, I've noticed over the years too, in being your friend and doing the show together, is that your attitude has changed incredibly around.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like so much more at peace.
Oh, that's
and so
good.
Much more accepting, and so much more just like, all right, well, this is welcome to my life, you know, as opposed to, this is my life.
That is a thank you for bringing that, because sometimes you don't see your own perspective in that. But I think I've sort of surrendered. I've been like, this is it. This is what it looks like. And so how can I make the best of it, or get the services I need? And so a lot of my anxiety was like, you know, right. I sort of channeled into getting needs for my kids at school and different things.
Which is probably had a reciprocal effect with your kids, right? Yeah. In terms of they're a little bit calmer. They see you more sturdy and strong. And so they don't, you know, they're not being mirrored this sort of anxiety through you, that which would add to their anxiety. So good job. Oh, okay, so name of the book.
The name of the book is Thriving with ADHD.
Uh-huh, and publisher?
Publisher is Callisto Media. Uh-huh. You can find it on Amazon. You can pre-order it now, or you can wait till June 26th.
Okay, and it's going to be in hardback or paperback or both?
Right now it's paperback.
Okay.
We'll see.
And Kindle?
That is up for determination. So we'll see. But thank you for allowing me to promote it.
Of course. Yay, Kelly.
You're so sweet. Thank
Kelly,
you.
Kelly, you rock. Woohoo. Okay. This is a great show today. We had a double treat, right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And next week we have Kelly Walden Sullivan, who's going to talk to us about dreams.
So cool.
So excited. And be sure to follow us on Instagram at Two Shrinks, Facebook, Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, website, docandtherapist.com, and keep sending those emails. We love you all. Thank you so much for joining.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.